Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks. This is Priya Menon, your host, and today we are discussing multiple myeloma. And we are super excited, the largest gathering of oncologists, researchers, and health professionals, the annual meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology 2019 just concluded yesterday, and we are looking forward to hear research updates from the meeting. And giving us his views and providing us with information is none other than Chief Medical Officer of the International Myeloma Foundation, Dr. Joseph McHale. Dr. McHale, welcome to Cure Talks. It's a pleasure to have you here with us.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure to join you today.
The myeloma panel talking to Dr. McHale today include advocates and survivors Gary Peterson, Cynthia Shmilevsky, Matt Goldman, and Dana Holmes. Gary will be co-hosting and leading the discussion. We will also be addressing questions from the audience towards the end of the discussion. You can post your questions on PriyaCureTalks.com or email it to Priya@Trilex.com. For asking your questions live, please dial in using 718-664-6574. I repeat, 718-664-6574. We have quite a bit to cover today, and I'm getting right into it. I will now hand over to Gary to introduce our expert and begin with the discussion. Gary, you're on.
Well, thank you, Priya, and thank you so much for providing this venue for the myeloma patient community. I am just honored to have the Chief Medical Officer for the International Myeloma Foundation, Dr. Joseph McHale. He works closely with the IMF, International Myeloma Foundation's chairman, and to advance the mission of the organization in research, education, advocacy, and patient care to improve the lives of patients with multiple myeloma. He was selected for this position from, you know, a world of myeloma specialists because Dr. McHale has a tremendous passion for education, travels the world lecturing, and develops collaborations in the myeloma community. Previously, Dr. McHale was hematology oncologist at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona, where he researched, taught, treated multiple myeloma and related condition. He also served as the Associate Dean of Graduate Medical Education and the Deputy Director of Mayo Clinic Comprehensive Cancer Center. After completing medical school and residency at the University of Ottawa, Yahe, he completed a second residency and fellowship at the University of Toronto and the Princess Margaret Hospital in Toronto, Ontario. Dr. McHale also served as a counselor on the American Society of Hematology executive and is involved in monitoring the next generation of hematologists. In addition, Dr. McHale is also putting on his plate, continuing his work in clinical and academic medicine with the City of Hope Cancer Center. So a lot going on with Dr. McHale, and so happy to have you with you. I grew up in Wisconsin. I'm in Wisconsin right now, so obviously I was a close neighbor originally. What I'd like to do now is to get into the questions, and the first of which is, you know, there are a bunch. It seems like there's one every week, but I don't know. Cancer meetings in the world each year, and some of them have a focus on myeloma and some do not. And so which are the most important for myeloma patients to observe, to follow, to watch?
Thanks, Gary. What a kind introduction. As I usually say, people just need to know my name is Joe and I'm here to give the talk. You don't need all that background, but that was very kind of you. I think it's actually a great question because it speaks to what's happening in myeloma, that myeloma has really been revolutionized over the last decade. I mean, had we had this conversation a year ago, I basically would have told you that we have one sort of most important meeting a year, the American Society of Hematology annual meeting, which always takes place in December. As you mentioned, I have the privilege of being on the executive of that organization. And that was really the overwhelming majority of where myeloma would be presented. But we have really seen a growth of that over the last several years, such that this meeting we just had, which is, of course, the largest cancer meeting in the world of 50,000 people at ASCO or the American Society of Clinical Oncology, also has a lot of myeloma presented at it. And then to add to the trio, we also have a meeting next week in Europe, the European Hematology Association meeting in Amsterdam, and we're also anticipating some very good discussion there, although there is tends to be a fair amount of overlap between what happened last weekend, this past week at ASCO, and what will happen next week at EHA. So for the myeloma patient community and just for the myeloma community in general, you know, you really need to have ears to the ground for these three major meetings. But frankly, there are others that come along as well. We have the International Myeloma Workshop that happens once every 2 years that will be taking place this year in September, from September 11th to 15th in Boston. And often new research and deeper discussions around features of myeloma are discussed. And then lastly, of course, you mentioned in my role as the Chief Medical Officer of the International Myeloma Foundation, at the meeting next week in Europe and also at the American Society of Hematology meeting, we have two live broadcasts with myself, Dr. Dury, and one or two other guests where we discuss the latest research as well. So I think if a myeloma patient can tap into those, not to mention the 24/7 Twitter feed of myeloma, then hopefully they can keep up with so many of the great things that are changing in this disease.
Yeah, well, that we have a couple of heavy hitters with the internet, and that would be the myeloma teacher Cindy Chmielewski and Dana Holmes. Dana Holmes is brand new, so we'd love to welcome, and not to the myeloma patient community, but certainly to this program, and we're just so happy to have her here and representing the smoldering group of multiple myeloma patients. It seems that we just had ASH not too long ago, and now we have the new one, ASCO. Do you see a general change in the direction or a shakeup in the direction for the treatment of multiple myeloma?
Well, it's an excellent question, Gary. Thank you. I would say that there's a constant shakeup. I mean, we are... And as evidenced by the abstracts that were just presented at ASCO, and I know we're going to dive in a little bit deeper to them, but to try and give people the balcony view, you know, the shakeup is at all aspects of myeloma, which is to say the very heart of its diagnosis, distinguishing smoldering from active myeloma. So there's the diagnostic side, if you will. Then there's the early intervention. We've had some great shakeup, in your words, over this last year about whether or not should we be jumping in earlier or not, and we can discuss that a little bit more when we get to the abstracts. And then we've seen significant change. This has probably been one of the greatest changes in this last, this revolution of myeloma in the last year, to see a lot of things changing in frontline myeloma, where now we're seeing the greater incorporation of monoclonal antibody drugs like daratumumab. And then lastly, we're absolutely seeing a lot of very interesting findings in very relapsed multiple myeloma. So with CAR T-cell therapies, with these new what are called bispecific antibodies. So, you know, it's hard for me to think of an area of myeloma that isn't currently being improved and worked on to benefit our patients. And so we literally do need these three or four meetings a year, because a lot happens in between. You know, if you have a news cycle where you're only ever listening to morning news, you're going to miss a lot during the day. A lot of things happen during the day. And so in the myeloma world, we have this constant turnover, and this last meeting was clear evidence of that.
That's quite a change unto itself, because it seems like there for, you know, many, many, many years, we just had like three or four different classes of drugs. And nothing else was happening, and now all of a sudden there's something of an explosion. But we're going to talk
Absolutely.
A little bit about that in the next part, which is of the abstracts presented at ASCO. which do you find to be some of the most interesting and why? And it's important, you know, we understand that the IMF has got their fingers in a lot of stuff, and that this is probably one of your major focuses. And as a result, you know, we certainly, now that the meeting is over, you know, and everybody has had a chance to try to digest what has come before, you know, that you have an opportunity to provide us with a tremendous opportunity for understanding from a patient's perspective what kind of things are happening for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the way I would structure my answer for this, Gary, is to think about what is most likely to immediately or in the very near future affect patients, and then what is going to affect patients a little bit further down the line. Because, you know, sometimes when a patient is being exposed to all of these different research articles and things being discussed, it's kind of hard to filter them. You might think, oh, my goodness, this sounds so great. Is this coming to the clinic next week? And so I think the way I would put it is this. I'd fancy that we could just look at five things really quickly. So number one is we saw a lot of evidence and discussion of using daratumumab more fully in the earlier settings. Now, we did have daratumumab approved technically with a combination that we don't normally use, bortezomib and melphalan, last year. But now we saw a New England Journal paper publication just last week and another presentation at this meeting where we're starting to see daratumumab come up front. And probably the immediate way to think about it, Gary, is that, as you mentioned, for so long we had, you know, the old school chemo, proteasome inhibitors like bortezomib and carfilzomib, and then we had immunomodulatory drugs like thalidomide and lenalidomide and pomalidomide. And historically, for frontline therapy, we took initially one and now two of those newer drugs, one proteasome inhibitor and one immunomodulatory drug, and combined them somehow, and that's how we treated people frontline. Well, now we have a whole new class to add. So now we've got sort of, if you will, three big choices: the proteasome inhibitors, the immunomodulatory drugs, and now monoclonal antibodies like daratumumab. And now we're seeing that in the very, very near future, like in the next couple of months, we're really going to be end up saying to most patients, all right, which two out of the three is best for you? Should we still go with the bortezomib lenalidomide combination up front, or should we use a monoclonal antibody and lenalidomide up front? So I think that's going to be the most immediate change that we're going to see now. You've got, out of these three drugs, we'll take two. If I can move thinking further ahead in that same vein, probably within a year from now, we may likely be actually using quadruplets in frontline therapy. We're actually just going to use those three drugs together plus steroids, what we call a quad, and use them all together. So someone will get something like daratumumab, bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. And that might sound like a big hammer, but we're starting to appreciate that if we treat myeloma very effectively up front, people can have a much longer remission and do better in the long term. And so we're still waiting on the data to mature, so that's not the instant thing for using those quadruplets or those quads, but I see that in the not-so-distant future. The second abstract that I found particularly important, we know it's coming, we've been talking about it, this may be the most patient-centric study of all of ASCO. If I was about to address a group of patients and someone said, you can only talk about one abstract, Joe, which one would it be? It would be the phase 3 trial, so a very big study, comparing giving daratumumab intravenously versus daratumumab subcutaneously. You know, many of the patients even listening in, I'm sure, have been on daratumumab and have sat through that first 8, 9, or 10-hour infusion, are now getting daratumumab either weekly or every other week or once monthly for 4 or 5 hours. They've now created a formulation of daratumumab where it's given for 5 minutes subcutaneously.
Oh,
and it was just, yeah, it's amazing. And it was just as effective as regular daratumumab and dramatically less of what we call those infusion reactions that people can get when they get Dara. So to me, that's number two in our five set here. where I really think this is going to affect patients. The third interesting abstract was presented, and I had the privilege of doing the very first in human study for this drug, was a drug called isatuximab. I know it's hard to get used to all these new names, but isatuximab is basically another version of daratumumab in that it has a similar mechanism of action as a monoclonal antibody, and it is quite likely going to be one of the, if not the next, one of the next two drugs approved in myeloma. It's not a new class, as it were, but we've also learned it's not just about getting new classes of drugs, it's about getting new drugs within each class. And so although
what was it originally called?
It had a lot of different names. It was called SAR with numbers after it, and there was a few iterations of that.
SAR.
So people often called it SAR. Over the last 4 years now, it's been known as isatuximab. You know, they all end in mab, meaning monoclonal antibody. And so this drug was presented as being combined with pomalidomide, and it'll likely be approved within a year to be used in combination with pomalidomide in patients with relapsed myeloma. I'd say the fourth set of discussion points that are interesting was the area of smoldering myeloma. You know, we're redefining the disease. As I tell patients, we used to define this disease as someone already had to have damage to their body or to their bones or their kidneys. It's like saying, if I'm going for a run today, I'm only going to stop my friend from falling off the cliff once they're falling off the cliff, because only then do I know they're in trouble. Well, no, I don't want to do that. I want to pull them away before they get to the cliff. And so a few years ago, we redefined myeloma to say, wait a minute, you don't just need the so-called CRAB criteria, or a calcium elevation, renal or kidney damage, anemia or low hemoglobin or bone disease. If you have a few other potential events, it tells us that maybe your kidneys aren't damaged yet, or maybe your bone isn't damaged yet, but it's on the way. So you're getting close to that cliff. Let's pull you back. And so we have some interesting work redefining how we think of smoldering, and even a study examining maybe those people that are at highest risk, those are the ones that are running fastest to the cliff, maybe we can treat them early on and prevent the disease, or at least delay the disease. And I don't think there's consensus yet that that's what we're doing, but we are trying to better define the line of when people should treat and not treat. And then lastly, I'll only present a little bit more because I know time's going quickly, is there was really a lot of excitement around new drugs that we have to treat very heavily relapsed myeloma. When most options are already used up, they're coming in a new class of drugs. And probably the one that right now is generating the most interest are these drugs that are called bispecific antibodies. And to make it simple for patients, think of this drug as a drug that has two arms. And when it's given to a patient, it grabs with one arm the actual tumor itself, kind of like our monoclonal antibodies do. It grabs tight on that tumor. But then with its other arm, it grabs onto the T cells of the patient. So these are like the soldier cells of a patient. And it actually activates those T cells with a nice good hand squeeze and gets that T cell to come and help destroy the tumor. So it's a really a beautiful example of how we can employ the immune system. You know, when we think of CAR T cell therapy, which is, of course, another whole topic in and of itself, although there wasn't a lot of new data on CAR T cell presented at ASCO, we'll see some later in the year. You know, for CAR T cells, you have to take T cells out of a patient and train them to the tumor and then put them back into the patient. That can be very effective, but this is a way to almost bypass all of that and just go directly to hook the tumor to the T cell and engage the T cell. Now, there's still some challenges with this drug. There are some side effects. The drug is given over a 28-day continuous infusion. It's not that easy. I think you had mentioned that, Cindy Chmielewski was one of the people reporting. She made what I thought was one of the funniest tweets I've ever seen about this. She said, well, if you're going to give me a backpack for 28 days, it better be a cute backpack, which I thought was quite funny in the way she described it. But the point being is that we're starting to see, you know, responses in patients
and this drug is very active. We still need to work with it. This is not ready for the clinic yet. But those are the key abstracts that had me excited about the myeloma world, knowing there's so many others, but knowing that we're making real progress here, my friend.
Well, that sounds wonderful, actually. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bypass my last question till later, if in fact we have enough time. But what I'd like to do now is to go on to the, you know, the other people on the panel, and I'd ask them if they would just ask two questions apiece, and same thing, we'll come back a little bit later after we've had an opportunity to talk to some of the listeners about what their questions are, and then we'll come back again and finish off with our questions. So, starting off, let's go with Cindy.
Hi,
Your
Dr.
questions,
Joe.
Cindy.
Hi, Dr. Joe. How you doing?
I'm doing great, my friend. Nice to see you, albeit for 3 seconds at ASCO. I'm glad I got to see you.
Right. Same here. So let me see some of my questions. I guess the first one is I'm going to ask you isn't about treatment, but I did attend a few sessions at ASCO this year on disparities in outcomes in myeloma patients. And they were saying that patients will not be seeing the same outcomes. Maybe live in geographic locations that aren't close to a center of excellence, or their socially economic status, types of insurance, and race. So this kind of bothered me, and I was wondering, is there any initiatives underway to address some of these disparities?
So thanks for asking that question, and it is so absolutely fundamental. I mean, we have seen this in other cancers, and we've known about this in myeloma and bits and pieces. But it's actually encouraging to me that there has been such an interest in understanding this so we can indeed reverse this problem, that individuals who have less access to drugs and less access to transplant and have a certain socioeconomic status in the community, and frankly our African-American patients who have twice the incidence of myeloma than Caucasian patients, do not have the same outcomes. We've seen all this great progress in myeloma in the last decade, but we've not seen it as fulfilled in the African American population. So, that, you know, to thinking like a doctor here, right? To cure a problem or to fix a problem, we need to know the problem. And thankfully, there's been a lot of work. I've never seen more papers published and more meetings to discuss the disparity question in myeloma than in the last 2 years. And so that's encouraging to me. But in direct answer to your question, absolutely. There are multiple initiatives across the country. I have just launched a large initiative through the International Myeloma Foundation where we are doing a whole series of things in terms of reaching out to the African-American community, leveraging, you know, the 150 support groups that we have across the country, recognizing that there are certain areas where there are greater concentrations of African-American patients and patients with these disparities, as you've described them, to better educate the community, to better educate the primary care doctors and the hematologist oncologists that are involved in their care, trying to devise means to not only have physical centers of excellence, but virtual centers of excellence, so that individuals can get input and advice if they're not able to travel to a center of excellence or to an expert in the area. So, you know, I have rarely seen a topic that has so impassioned many of us within the myeloma community, and I speak with a passionate heart when I say this is a problem that we want to address, and I'm thankful that many steps are being taken in that vein. I should also mention that part of the way this will be come to fruition, of course, is will be a great partnership with a whole host of individuals. We've partnered with the Black Congressional Caucus, with individuals from industry, with individuals from the religious and social community. And so I'm very optimistic that we're going to start to see the gap filled and start to see things move in the right direction.
Great. That's what I wanted to hear. You're so good at explaining how things work. Could you talk about a little bit, the drug selinexor has a unique mechanism of action. Could you describe that a little bit, and why is this drug potentially going to be valuable in myeloma therapy? And is there any insight on what's happening with the FDA and FDA approval for selinexor?
Sure. Great. You always come, all of you always come up with great questions. So it's ironic. I came from the lab this morning at TGen, and we were discussing the mechanism of action of selinexor. Now, if I repeat what was said in the lab, you think I'm speaking a different language. So let me make it a little bit more straightforward. Let me put it this way. First of all, to have people understand the concept of a mechanism of action, I often use this analogy. You know me and my analogies. So you're about to get two of them. I'm warning you. Spoiler alert, Dr. Joe is going to give two analogies. So analogy number one is, imagine that trying to take down myeloma is like trying to get into a house, okay? And so naturally there's a front door and there's a back door and there may be a side door. So the front door are proteasome inhibitors, and we know that we just keep going in that front door and we can get to the myeloma. This is good. But eventually the myeloma is smart enough, and it says, you know what? We're going to lock the front door. We're going to barricade the front door, and so we can't get in. So what you really want is another way to get into the building. You want a different mechanism of action. You want that back door as the immunomodulatory drugs, or you want the side door like the monoclonal antibodies. But eventually, unfortunately, this disease gets really smart, and it starts blocking all the ways to come in. So we can keep trying to get better ways to go through the front door, you know, a stronger, push through the front door. Yes, we have newer versions of older drugs, and that helps to a certain extent. But what we really want is something different. We want to find a new window. We're like, hey, look, there's a window over here. Let's go in through here. Or there's a side door here. There's a small door here. Or there's an attic here. There's a basement here. So the complexity of myelomas, there's 100 different ways to get into this building. Some of them are tiny holes, some of them are bigger, and we want to find those ones that let us get in. So selinexor is, if you will, a new mechanism of action, and it's treating the cell very differently than we did before. There's lots of ways to describe it, but my second analogy is what we have learned is that inside the nucleus of our cells, we have these good things that help suppress tumors. We call them tumor suppressors. And they are very good at trying to make sure that tumors don't damage the body. Again, I'm being very simple, but this is important. The problem is they leave the nucleus and they go off outside the nucleus. Sometimes they cycle back in, but they spend a lot of time leaving. And what we wish we could do is, if only we could keep those tumor suppressors inside the nucleus, we could have them working for longer. So my analogy is, you are hosting, you and Gary and Priya are hosting a big party, and everybody's coming to your party, but you know that there's some of those really cool people that, as long as they stay at the party, everyone else is going to have a really good time. So once they arrive at the party, then you close the doors and you don't let people leave. And I know that sounds really bad. I'm not trying to say you're imprisoning anybody, but the concept is that as long as you can keep those cool people at the party, everybody's having a good time. As long as we can keep those tumor suppressors inside the nucleus. And so this drug inhibits the export or stops the departure of these good tumor suppressors so that they stay inside the nucleus. I do think that this is an important drug because it is another mechanism of action. There have been some challenges with this drug in some of the side effects, but we're learning to overcome those in different ways. In fact, a group of us met to discuss this at length just recently to find ways to develop best practices so that when this drug comes out, people know how to prevent the nausea or the lack of appetite that can sometimes carry through with this drug. I don't have any insider information, and if I did, I'd be careful to share anything. All I know is that this drug does have another
assigned date in July where it'll be more formally reviewed by the FDA, and we anticipate positivity. I think that this drug in the near future will be available to us. It might only be available in, you know, a fairly narrow area of people who have, if you will, block the front door, the back door, and the side door, you know, people who have been exposed to and have been resistant to monoclonal antibodies, proteasome inhibitors, and immunomodulatory drugs. But I do think that will be its foot in the door because chances are we'll use it in combination later.
Great. I love your analogies. Keep using them. So I guess.
Okay, thank you.
I guess Matt's up next, Gary. Is that where?
Yeah, Matt's up next.
Question?
But... yeah, I also had the same feeling about Selinexor, you know, and at ASH in December, everybody was, you know, touting it, and it was going to be the next best thing, and then the FDA squashed it, and it never even showed up on the radar for ASCO. So I was wondering, is it dead or what's the situation? But it sounds what Dr. Joe McHale has indicated is that there is hope for that drug because it sounded excellent. The only difference, the only reason it didn't make it is that there was one less representative on that panel who understood myeloma. You know, everybody else was kind of ignorant of it, is my opinion. I mean, you know, not like a myeloma specialist. If we had one more myeloma specialist on that panel, we would have had that drug already, but that's to be determined. Now, Matt, it's your turn.
All right, thanks, Gary. Hi, Dr. Joe.
Hey.
You've almost answered all my questions, so I'll make this easy and just ask one, which is, with all the advances in treatment options and like you said, the use of monoclonal antibodies as a frontline drug, is that changing how we're using transplants or if transplants are being done?
Yeah, I think you ask actually a very insightful question, Matt, and if I were going through the whole ASCO review, I would have reviewed what for me was one of the most fascinating studies that was presented, looking at can we actually avoid transplant? And to make it simple, let me start my answer by saying, right now, autologous stem cell transplant for patients who are eligible remains the standard of care. And I honestly don't think anything at ASCO has changed that. I still think it is the standard. I think, on the other hand, if you discuss this with most myeloma experts, most of us will say it probably won't remain that way forever. We do think that whether it gets replaced with certain forms of CAR T-cell therapy or just novel agents, then maybe that will be the case. But there was a very important study that was presented at ASCO by our Italian friend, a good friend of mine, Francesca Gay, and she presented a study which had three arms to it. But to keep it simple, I'll just speak about two arms. So patients were basically given a year of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, versus getting that plus a transplant. And the you know, intent was, can a year of this kind of novel therapy be enough? When we had the last year, 2 years ago, the French study that showed to us that we had bortezomib, lenalidomide, dex, plus or minus transplant, there was still a benefit of transplant. Although, you know, the bortezomib, lendex was only given for 3 months before transplant or 8 months in total if you didn't get a transplant. So the question here is, if we give carfilzomib, which may be more potent, and we give it for a full year, is that going to be enough? And initially it looked like that because the response rates were very similar and the depth of response was very similar in those patients. But what we found was that those patients that had not a transplant, so the non-transplant group, their disease relapsed a little bit more quickly than those who had a transplant. So when you transplant, remember, your intention is both depth of response and duration of response. So it's important to not just see the numbers go down, but to stay down. And it looks like the KRD, or the carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dex, alone although it gave you a very similar depth of response to the same group getting a transplant, it didn't keep you in remission for quite as long. And so right now, you know, we still have to mull this over. The study is not finished. We've all been in trouble by overinterpreting early data, so we don't want to go overboard. But I think right now it still sustains the notion that transplant still has a role, Matt.
Okay, thanks. And Gary, that's all I have.
Well, thank you, Matt. A very, very insightful question. Thank you so much. And now for the newbie, Dana Holmes. You're up.
Thanks, Gary. Hi, Dr. Joe. Your analogies are always so easy to understand and remember. Your bucket spilling over analogy regarding smoldering was one of the first interviews I listened to when I was first diagnosed, and I was hooked. So thank you for taking the time to always break it down and make it so easy. Dr. Joe, I believe a Mayo study a couple of years ago reported 11, 14 myeloma patients were not showing much benefit in overall survival as other myeloma subtypes were in the age of novel agents, suggesting that it might not be quite standard risk after all, and prognosis may be inferior to what had long been, thought of. So I'm going to cite three ASCO abstracts that seem to kind of now put us on the good side of the road. Dr. Gasparato had abstract 8032 using the Myeloma Connect registry, which suggests 1114 does not affect progression-free survival or overall survival outcomes in newly diagnosed patients. The Hackensack group did E19531, which concluded real-world databases are useful in describing treatment patterns and outcomes in narrowly defined cohorts such as myeloma with 1114. The overall survival results reported here is unexpectedly long and will be fully explored prior to presentation. So I guess that must have just and I missed the presentation, of course. And then finally, abstract 8015, which was an IMWG study, reports 1114 patients receiving a combination of a PI and IMID appear to have the best survival outcomes, and those receiving an early stem cell transplant appear to have excellent survival with medium overall survival approaching 10 years. So can you comment, please, especially in light of the fact that we may no longer now have venetoclax in our toolbox? Where do those patients with 1114 actually stand at this point?
Wow, Dana.
Wow, I know. I'm sorry.
It's honestly, we discuss this all the time. I joke sometimes, Dana, and say, you know, you put 10 myeloma experts in a room and you have 12 opinions. Right?
Uh huh. I'm an 1114, so.
No, I understand. I stand for sure. And that's why I'm glad you're asking this. I mean, the way to back up for a quick sec and help the listeners appreciate this, you know, I often say the disease is called multiple myeloma for good cause, meaning, you know, patients are very different with this disease. It really is multiple diseases in one. And one of the things we've actually identified is that the biology of the disease is really quite different. That lab meeting I was discussing this morning that we were in, we were looking at, you know, the vast different genetic changes that we have in this tumor. And we have some forms of myeloma that are really slow growing, some that are very fast growing, some that are sensitive to chemo, some that are insensitive to chemo. And we really almost have six different diseases in one. Translocation 1114, which just means that a little piece of chromosome 11 and a little piece of chromosome 14 that normally don't cohabitate are now cohabitating together, and that changes the effect on the cells of the tumor, is what we call translocation 1114. And if we go way back to some of the first work that was done almost 15 years ago by Rafael Fonseca and others, we saw that this was a distinct group of patients, that their disease was a little bit different, and it looked at the time that maybe their long-term outcomes were a little bit better than those who didn't have it or those who had different genetic abnormalities. I think most of us believe that that still holds true. There have been a few blips along the way. There, as you mentioned, there was a Mayo study. There was another study that looked and maybe said, oh, maybe these individuals don't respond well to proteasome inhibitors. That's one of the reasons why Dr. Duri and the IMWG did this study. The problem is there's so much background noise. It's not incredibly common. I mean, it is 15% of myeloma patients, but it's not all myeloma patients. And there are lots of other variables. It's like saying to me, do Subaru drivers, when their Subaru car is gray and they're driving on Thursdays, are they more likely to get a speeding ticket than if they drive on Tuesdays? Well, a whole lot of variables depend on that, right? Maybe there's certain people that don't drive on Tuesdays and that do drive on Thursdays. Maybe the traffic patterns are different. Maybe police officers are more likely to give out tickets on certain days. I explain this to patients because I say to them, yes, there are genetic things, but this is one piece of the whole puzzle. You know, myeloma is so complicated that it's hard to say. So for any individual patient, we've all seen patients that have even the so-called high-risk cytogenetics, like the deletion 17P or the translocation 414, do extremely well. And then in other cases, we've seen patients that don't have any of these high-risk features, and they sadly do very poorly. So it's always important to distinguish the sort of global pattern versus the individual patient difference. But in light of the studies that you quoted, and I know them very well, and we've had discussions around them, I think right now most of us believe that translocation 1114 is a little bit different biologically. It has the potential, if treated with even the drugs we have now appropriately, for those patients to have a very long survival, perhaps longer than the average. My last comment would be, I know you mentioned that there are some challenges with venetoclax. The FDA has put a hold on all clinical trials with venetoclax right now in myeloma as we review carefully what happened in that large study where, unfortunately, there were more patients in the venetoclax Velcade arm that died compared to those who were in the Velcade arm alone. I would say, Dana, most of us believe in the myeloma community that venetoclax does have a role to play in myeloma. Maybe it's only in the 1114 patients. Maybe it's under certain precautions. We don't really know yet. But most of us feel that what happened is not a complete deal breaker because so many of us have seen patients truly benefit from the venetoclax. So to put it all together, I would say most of us in the myeloma community still feel that if given the appropriate treatment, patients with translocation 1114 will do better than the average and that likely in some form will still have venetoclax available and probably especially for that group.
Glad to hear all of the above, certainly. My next question is specific to smoldering myeloma and Dr. Loniel's ECOG trial, the lenalidomide versus observation alone in high-risk smoldering patients. Was it intended from the outset of this trial to include smoldering patients who were intermediate risk, or did the fact that the progression risk models evolved during the time of the trial causing intermediate risk patients to inadvertently be accrued for this trial? You know, looking now also at this new model, the 2220, which more aptly defines and differentiates high risk, intermediate, and low risk, it's clear that the former model that they used in the ECOG trial really didn't. So how are we then able to actually interpret the outcomes of this trial if those with intermediate risk were inadvertently included in the data? Have the researchers actually teased out the intermediate risk from the high-risk patients? I guess, really, how important is it to even do that? And I think I'm so fixated on this because of the excitement that I'm hearing and feeling over the results, results which may lead to change in practice, Dr. Joe. I use myself as an example. I was diagnosed back in early 2012, and I met the criteria for this particular clinical trial. However, I didn't enroll. I haven't been treated, and I remain stable 7 years out. But had I enrolled and received Revlimid and even just remained stable on it, it would have been reported it was the Revlimid which kept me from progressing. So, you know, in light of this, I'm being cautious as to how I'm looking at these results, especially as I just viewed a video this morning from a presentation that Dr. Rajay gave, I guess at ASCO, where she stated that there was a doubling of secondary malignant cancers in the treatment arm of this particular trial. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, again, Dana, very, very insightful and complex question, and I'm conscious of time, but I want to answer this, and I want to answer it very carefully because this is so absolutely important. You know,
it's very
different when we say, oh, look, we've developed a new drug that we can add on to a regimen, or we've developed a new class of drug that is going to be used in patients that are very heavily pretreated. That is massively different than potentially saying that we are going to treat basically well patients with a drug. The bar has to be so much higher because the potential for risk is massive.
Right? I agree.
It's like saying 5% of the adult population probably has some form of MGUS. I am not going to treat 5% of this planet, right? I mean, you have to be careful because if the treatment, no matter what the treatment is, everything comes with risk, right? As I sometimes say, unless it's mother's milk, everything comes with real risk. You know, the very first patient ever treated on the thalidomide smoldering myeloma study tragically died 6 weeks after starting of a massive blood clot to the lungs. And it was a reminder to us that the most sacred adage we have in medicine is above all, do no harm. Now, that has to be balanced, right? Everyone on this call is at some point going to get onto the highway probably in the next week or so. And we know there's a risk of getting hit when you drive and when you fly.
Yep.
And so we all accept some degree of risk. Now, with that as the background, I do not think that this study is practice changing. And I'm in the camp of people, which is, I believe, still the majority of myeloma physicians and treaters and providers who feel that there are big issues with both this study and the Spanish study, and I disagree with Dr. Lonial that we are immediately treating all high-risk smoldering myeloma for a lot of reasons. One, because just as you've said, as the lines change, of course, and it's understandable, definitions change, entry criteria, it has to catch up, and this isn't reflecting what we think of the new biology of the disease. Secondly, although the drug did prevent, or at least delay, we have to distinguish delay versus prevent. You know, some of the great work we're doing at the IMS, the International Myeloma Working Group, is yes, I mean, who wouldn't want to prevent a disease? But do I really believe, although it's a fantastic drug, do I really think lenalidomide alone is actually going to prevent myeloma? Absolutely not. I think there's a lot more to the immune system than just doing that. And then, as you've said, there are, as always, certain toxicities. I'm going to accept a slight increase in second cancers in a patient who already has a defined cancer that's needed treatment. And, you know, as it were, the devil you know versus the devil you don't. I mean, I'm hesitant to not give someone a drug I know is going to make them live longer because they have a 1% or 2% chance of developing something new. But when it's a patient who is asymptomatic, who doesn't yet have an active disease, granted, it was 50% higher. It was about 2.5% to 4.5%. So the absolute difference was about 2 or 2.25%. It's not a huge percent, but it adds up. And the last point I'll make is that, unfortunately, 51% of patients on that study had to come off the drug. So this is not, you know, the ideal strategy for high-risk disease. Yes, the drug is very well-tolerated in general, but people who are really well, they don't want any effect on their quality of life. And so the fact that half the patients couldn't stay on the drug for the intended period, now, Dr. Lonial's response when I asked him that question was, well, maybe they don't need it as long as we anticipated they needed it. And that's a very good point, and we need to examine it. But I think there's still enough unanswered questions that right now, the strategy of saying let's better define smoldering myeloma so we know what needs really to be treated. And if you're going to treat myeloma, we treat it fully. We don't have to treat it with lenalidomide alone.
Yep.
And going
I
back
agree
to
wholeheartedly.
Earlier,
I really do. Mm-hmm.
We're starting to draw lines close to the cliff and say, if you cross this line, then we're going to treat you as if you were falling down the cliff because you're just so close. You know, I think many of us almost feel that we might have smoldering myeloma disappear from a definition and just say everything up to a certain point is basically MGUS. Everything after that is active myeloma and draw that
whether
line.
Whether it's we're earlier or advanced. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Correct. We're not there yet.
I just think the excitement, I think the excitement needs to be tempered a bit because I think it could do a lot more damage than good, especially within the community oncology group who may not really be putting a lot of thought into it and just throwing their patients onto Rev and Dex. So I'm glad
that we
addressed this. Thank you.
You sound just like I did after the abstract. I mean, I don't ever want to temper people's excitement about research. This is what we do, and this is wonderful, but I am clearly not telling anybody to run out to their oncologist and get smoldering myeloma treated right away. I do not think that is wise, and I share your conservative approach.
I do think, however, that there are two arguments to be made, though, still about whether it's good enough to just control the disease for the rest of my life or just to knock it out of the park. I mean, if I could be guaranteed that I could, you know, have it controlled for the rest of my life and live a decent quality of life, then that's an option, you know, taking the risks into consideration. But I think that these questions have not been answered yet.
And I think in the broader picture for the audience, I know we're going to turn to other questions momentarily, but, you know, that is a really important principle in general, right? People ask me all the time, when are we going to cure myeloma? And, you know, curing myeloma is complicated. It's like saying, when are we going to fix the economy? It's not one thing that'll change the economy tomorrow. There's lots of things that go into it. And so we don't cure high blood pressure or diabetes. We control it in the long term. We may have to go down more of a path of controlling. Obviously, we'd like to cure, which basically means you give someone a defined period of time of treatment, and then they don't need any more treatment. We're not there yet, but we're definitely getting closer to it with these great combinations we've developed.
Well, Dr. Joe, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dana. You've done a great job. What I'd like to do now is to turn it over to Priya, and Priya, would you bring up the callers on the line? And if we get through all of those, we'll go back around with additional questions from the panel.
Yeah, sure. Listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Joe, please dial in using 718-664-6574. We have a caller. Bonnie is here who wants to ask a question. Bonnie, you're on air. Please ask your question.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Dr. Jim. Thanks so much for your time. I have questions about the stem cell that are around the topic of stem cell transplant. I watched Dr. Rajay's presentation of Dr. Gay's study, and she pointed out that the maintenance randomization ended up sort of blurry, in her opinion, being able to draw a conclusion about the advantages of stem cell transplant. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
Sorry, you were concerned about her comments about the blurriness of maintenance therapy?
No, the fact that the maintenance in the Forte trial was randomized ended up...
Oh, understood.
Yes,
I got you. So there was a further randomization thereafter. Now I understand what you're saying. Sorry, I just wanted to make sure that we're clearly on the same page.
Yeah.
You know, this is sort of a traditional challenge that we always have in myeloma, which is sometimes when you see results in a study, it's not just a function of what's happening in the study. It's a function of what happens after the study. So in the study that I described, patients get carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, basically plus or minus a transplant, and then they continue that. But there was a so-called second randomization where patients either continued on carfilzomib and lenalidomide or just lenalidomide. And it's still too early to know if we know it's too early to know if that second randomization and the path that people took later may have influenced the comments I made earlier about relapsing sooner.
Right.
Either way, it is, you know, it still speaks to the power of transplants earlier on, but it may also speak to the weakness or the power of that second randomization, which is why we do that, so that we can see, you know, it's not just about one step, it's about a second step in the disease. So I think that, you know, the jury's still out on this, as it were. It's still a little bit early to draw that conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
The comment from Dr. Rajay is very insightful, which points to the fact that, as I said earlier, we need, you know, longer follow-up of these studies. We've all been led astray, right? As I sometimes say, going back to my analogies, you know, you want to predict the end of the Super Bowl at halftime or even after the third quarter. That doesn't always work, right? There are a lot of Super Bowls that have been determined at the very end. And so these studies, although we allow them to be presented at earlier points in their treatment so that we can detect early trends, either positive or negative, we need to wait a little bit longer to understand that.
Thank you. I understand that. And just clarify one thing for me. Tell me if my thinking is on track here. I mean, all over the internet, patients are constantly asking, you know, should I go on maintenance or should I have a stem cell transplant? And everybody presents their arguments back and forth. But there's sort of one background assumption that I want to check with you, and that is that we're assuming that people have the option to do a delayed transplant if it doesn't all work out with the novel agents up front. But like this study, the Forte trial, it's only comparing novel agents versus an upfront transplant, but it doesn't clarify whether or not it is wise to wait for a delayed transplant for certain patients because they may not have that option down the road.
Correct, and that's just a reality that no one study can answer all of those questions, right? Which is why some of them, you know, we end up having to say there's only so much you can gain from each study. But we learned a little bit more about that from the French study, the IFM study, where patients who didn't have a transplant in the transplant arm, but when they relapsed, they were allowed to go to transplant, of course, and 80% of them or 79% of them had a transplant at first relapse. So we knew it was feasible. So many people look at that study and say, oh, well, we can do a second transplant or delayed transplant, not second transplant, delayed transplant. This study isn't designed to answer that question. But, you know, I think it's an important discussion to have with patients. I think it's reasonable to delay a transplant if there are certain conditions that are met, but usually not beyond the first relapse. We really should plan to give it at first relapse.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Person calling in from 938-8084, please ask your question.
Sorry, no question. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
No question. I'm listening here.
Okay, thank you for dialing in. Dr. McGill, we have a couple of questions posted on the page, that people are listening to. Let me just quickly go over those. One of the persons says, what are the most promising drugs forthcoming to treat multiple myeloma for those of us who have had numerous lines of treatment? What are the best ways for patients to stay as healthy as possible and as long as possible?
So for the great questions, of course. I mean, the most promising drugs, I think, as we've mentioned, the two drugs that will likely see approval in the next year would be selinexor, as described earlier, and isatuximab, which is the new monoclonal antibody. Chances are for those patients that have had multiply relapsed disease, selinexor would be an option for them. Looking a little bit further out, there's still the potential of venetoclax, as I've mentioned. But then there are a whole series of others that are in line. I don't know if I've ever known a time in myeloma where you have this many drugs that are in the pathway have even been brought to the FDA. Gary, you even tweeted about another one yesterday. But I think the ones that we're looking a little bit more closely at are these monoclonal antibodies that affect the BCMA target, not just the CD38 target. BCMA is something that almost all myeloma cells have on their surface. And so GlaxoSmithKline, for example, has a drug that's in development that we may see approved potentially in later of next year. And then I mentioned the bispecific antibody, that drug that has two arms. And again, still early on, but it speaks to the fact that we're getting these new generation drugs that will have quite likely a significant impact on myeloma. For those patients that are waiting for something very near, a lot of these are going to be in clinical trials, of course, but not approved within the next year. And the second question was how to remain healthy and happy.
Yeah.
Well, that is a whole talk in of itself. I mean, I think some of the things we've simply demonstrated is, and I say this over and over, and we have survival data now to demonstrate that open, honest, clear communication with your treating provider team is absolutely fundamental. Not hiding your symptoms, not hiding your side effects, being open and honest really provides for the best discussion. And for me, I'm a big advocate of the quality of life of patients and their own preference. Don't let a doctor tell you you'll take it and you'll like it and you'll ask for more. I mean, that's not how the profession should work. I think patients empowering themselves on calls like this, educating themselves in the best way they feel possible, making sure that they don't feel like a bystander in their appointments, but they are really a partner with their team. And, of course, recognizing what's valuable to them. When my patient tells me that travel is important to them or a certain meal or visiting their grandchildren or, you know, we want to bend over backwards. We don't treat people. We don't treat myeloma. We treat people. And we don't treat people for a sake of a number. We treat people so they can be who they are and want to be. And if that's not what's happening in your treating environment, then that has to be reevaluated.
Thank you so much, Dr. Go. I think the hour just flew by, and we still have plenty of questions, but we have to wrap up now. And that was an absolutely splendid discussion. Thank you for your time and all the information shared, Dr. Mikhail. Gary, Cindy, Matt, and Dana, thank you for participating and the great questions. I hope we had some more time to, you know, discuss some more, but we have to be mindful of Dr. Mikhail's time as well. Thank you to the audience. The talk and transcript will be available on our website. Please visit curetalks.com for details of upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mikhail. You did an outstanding job.